Welcome to a Migration Policy Institute podcast series on critical immigration, health, and educational policies affecting young children of immigrants. Introducing each session is Michael Fix, Senior Vice President and Director of Studies and Co-Director of the National Center on Immigrant Integration Policy. And now here's Michael.
We're going to have a star panel that'll take up the issue of the trajectories of immigrants growing up in families where one or more of the parents are undocumented and where a million children themselves are undocumented in the United States. Doris Meisner has graciously agreed to moderate that panel.
Okay, we're going to get started now on our last session. And this is the session that tries to take us back to programs in immigration policy and back to the intersections between immigration as it's in the law and some of the policy issues that have to do with current practices as well as what could, should perhaps change in the context of immigration reform. So we have three speakers. We're going to start with David Thronson, who is a professor of law at Michigan State University, and that's going to be followed by Hiro Yoshikawa. David is going to talk to us about the way in which children fit, how children are treated, what the issues surrounding children and families are in immigration law, and this is, of course, an important foundation for discussing some of the programmatic and policy work that Hiro will have. And the final speaker is going to be Kelly Ryan, who is Acting Deputy Assistant Secretary at the Department of Homeland Security in the Policy Office and has been for many, many years interested as part of her work in the government in the immigration realm in issues of children and how immigration law affects children. Because we have a PowerPoint in our second presentation, we're going to stay away from the podium until Hiro is finished. I'm going to invite David to come to the podium.
So thank you for letting me be the lawyer amidst all these great researchers here today and to talk a little bit about ways in which, as we've heard, immigration status matters in terms of how kids are treated, in terms of how they access other systems, in terms of how they thrive or don't thrive in a variety of settings across our country. And we want to take a look at what our immigration law actually does and use children, as we've seen, children as a lens to look at our healthcare system and children as a lens to look at our education system. Let's look at children and families as a lens to look at our immigration law system. Because we often start from, I think, a mistaken premise of what our immigration law actually is and how it actually functions and how it actually works. And I want to try and expose that myth a little bit today and have us rethink how we might approach children in immigration law. I think most conversations start with this notion that family reunification is a real bedrock principle in our immigration law. If you look at certain numbers, that's easy to start with as a premise and say, well, that makes sense. About 70-plus percent of lawful immigration to the United States takes place on the basis of a family connection, either through our family-sponsored programs or through someone who's a derivative, a child or a spouse of someone who's coming on an employment-based program. So family does play this very huge, almost outsized role in our lawful immigration program. But at the same time, we've got other populations to look at and say, well, gee, while that's going on, while family is playing this important role in one aspect of immigration law, how do family ties, how does childhood play out and matter in other aspects of immigration law? And the picture's not quite so rosy in terms of how we value children and what we think about in those pictures. As we look at our population, and these are numbers that people in this room have generated and know much better than I, but worth sort of throwing out again as framing to think around what happens here. We have over a million undocumented children in this country, children who do not have immigration status. Their childhood, the fact of their childhood, doesn't provide them any particular rights to achieve immigration status. We have lots of children who are integrated into families, U.S. citizen children and undocumented children alike. About 5 million children have an undocumented parent. Many of those, about 80% of those, are U.S. citizens. So we've got, in the neighborhood of 4 million U.S. citizen children who have undocumented parents. They're directly impacted by our immigration laws. About 9 million people, all told, live in a family unit with someone who is undocumented. So if our if family matters, and we've got this world of mixed status families going on, what is it that's saying some families are okay, families important to immigration law, and what is it about other families that aren't okay? And one of the places where we look at it and we say what works for families and what doesn't is that immigration law is very adult-centered. It's not child-centered. It doesn't take children's interests into account as we move forward. As we look at the frameworks that set up immigration law and who is permitted to come, they're centered around adults, not children's interests. And you know, one of the things we often forget about immigration law is that, you know, it feels like, especially as someone who practices immigration law, feels like a big centralized bureaucracy and you're dealing with this monolith at the center of a federal government. But really what immigration law is about is empowering individuals to make choices about who they can bring and extend lawful status to in the United States. If I get married and I'm a U.S. citizen, I have some rights to generate immigration rights in my spouse. If I have stepchildren or if I have children, I can generate immigration and citizenship rights in my children. I am a generator of immigration rights, and immigration law, what it does is empower me to do that, lets me be that source of immigration rights. Immigration law does not allow children to empower immigration rights in others. Our frameworks of family immigration allow children to follow parents, allow parents to include children in their applications, but they don't take children into account in saying the fact that you're a U.S. citizen child and you have a parent who's out there somewhere, you can reach out and somehow empower or enable rights in that parent. We have a one-way street as that goes. Now, that trickles out further as we go through immigration law. And this gets into some of the details of immigration law, but it's pervasive in the way immigration. I'll give you one example. One of the big roadblocks to lawful status in the United States are what are often referred to as the 3 and 10 year bars. These are rules in place that say if you've been in the United States for more than 180 days unlawfully and you leave the United States, you're not permitted to return for 3 years. If you're in the United States unlawfully for more than a year and you leave, you're not permitted to return for 10 years, hence the 3 and 10 year bars to this. Now, what's tricky about this, right, and this is where the details come into this, is it's triggered when you leave the United States. So problem comes into to play and say, well, who does this impact? Well, it impacts primarily people who entered the United States without inspection because of another rule that says you can't process your immigration status here in the United States. You can't do this thing called adjustment of status, which is a local processing, if you entered the United States without inspection. So those are the folks who, in order to move forward through the system, despite having eligibility for a visa, despite being perhaps married to a U.S. citizen or having a job that would be potentially able to offer them a pathway under our normal processes in immigration, these are people who need to leave the country to process. And the minute they do that, they trigger a 3 year or in most cases a 10 year bar, and therefore they don't leave. They don't come in. Now, we put a waiver of that in place in the law to say, you know, this might cause hardship, right? It's unsurprisingly, it does cause hardship. What's relevant when we look at the hardship waiver? Hardship to a spouse or hardship to a parent of an adult? Not hardship to children. We write that out. We specifically leave that out of the law, right? We know that there's going to be hardship to children, but we don't make that relevant to the calculus as we're deciding what happens. So there's one way, again, where we're saying children aren't permitted to be generators of rights of immigration and others. Even at extremes, we're very hesitant to let anything negative happen to children drive our immigration calculus. About 4,000, limited by statute to 4,000 cases per year, are permitted to achieve something called cancellation of removal. This is someone who has been in the United States for more than 10 years, has built up a lot of positive equities, who has no disqualifying criminal activity, and is facing removal from the United States, and we can cancel that removal order from the United States. Now, the standard to do that, however, used to be extreme hardship to a qualifying relative. This time we include children. But in 1996, we decided extreme hardship wasn't enough, that we have to have exceptional and extremely unusual hardship before we're going to say this is enough to look at the way we treat children and say that should cancel someone's removal order. Well, what happens in that case then? We look and say every case where a family is separated by removal order, by the enforcement of immigration law, we expect hardship. It's a normal part of the process. So unless we have something truly exceptional, extremely unusual, we're not going to say that hardship is relevant to what happened. So we take hardship and we look at that and say, hardship to children is not important. Only in these truly, truly extreme handful of cases will we look at that. Then we look at how we treat children themselves in the law. And by and large, we treat children exactly the way we treat adults. We have a few procedural protections since the TVPRA in 2008. We have a few more procedural protections. But substantively, if you want to qualify for asylum, you're looking at the same standards as a child that you're meeting as an adult. If we're looking at the same type of harm that you would face to be able to stay in the country, the same standards are applying to children that are applying to adults in all those instances. We're also imposing the same types of penalties on children for prior violations of immigration law. So if we look at immigration law in the past, someone who entered the country without inspection is barred from moving forward in our immigration process without leaving the country and going through a lot of other steps. Well, it doesn't matter if you entered the country at the age of 23 and did it consciously and knowingly, or if you entered the country at the age of 3, carried over the border by somebody else. The same consequence attaches to you, even if you did this as a child, even if you had no conscious effort or decision-making in the process as you go forward. So we have a variety of ways in which our immigration law is not particularly child-friendly, actually goes out of its way to penalize children and thinks about ways in which we're going to make it very, very difficult for status to ever flow from children to families. Into families. Now, as we've seen from our statistics earlier today, that's problematic in the sense that most children, we work a lot with unaccompanied minors in this country, we have a variety of programs, but those numbers are really dwarfed by the number of children who are living with their families, who are here in the United States. So if we're talking about ways in which we want to think about how immigration reform might look forward, we should look at ways in which a child's immigration status, a child's claim to citizenship in the United States, a child's claim on this country might inform our decisions about who then, as an adult, achieves immigration status as we look forward. Now, most immigration reform efforts that we've had in the past tend to create new laws. They don't change a lot that's in our standard framework of the law. They tend to look backwards and say, let's pick a cohort, let's pick a time, people who arrive before a certain date, after a certain date, who meet certain criteria, who don't meet certain disqualifying criteria, and we'll take those people and we'll carve them out, and we'll look at that group and say, that's the group that we are going to give legal status to. But we don't do an awful lot of tinkering to the actual framework of the law that got us there. We don't look at it and say, well, gee, why did we end up with 11 million people who are undocumented in this country? Why is it that there are, you know, 5 million U.S. citizen children who have undocumented parents? What is it about our system that doesn't respond to that disconnect between children who have status and parents who do not? And how do we think about blending that through? Now, how might this look? What might this be as we're thinking about ways to frame rhetoric and reform? Now, you know, you hear the stuff about, you know, STEM, the need to extend visas to people, you know, who are in STEM fields. And people say, well, gee, let's, you know, staple a visa onto every STEM diploma as we, you know, walk out of the across the stage and get your diploma. Nobody is ever going to suggest, let's staple a visa onto every birth certificate of a U.S. Citizen child born here in the United States. That's the myth of the anchor baby that floats around as rhetoric, and people believe that, to some extent that's true, that essentially having a child here does get you status and move forward. The numbers belie that. The law belies that. It doesn't happen. It's not a process under which we can move forward and work. But as we think about how the law should be reformed, the idea that we need to go as far as to be antagonistic to children's interests in immigration law, and we shouldn't be factoring those interests in at some point and worried about the hardship and the impact of the lack of parent status on children, should also be part of our thinking and our rhetoric as we go forward. The best source in most instances for, raising kids is their family and their homes, and kids fare better in families than they do in any other place that we've, come up with to help them move forward. So, how can we think about ways that children's status and children's rights and children's as generators of immigration right inform the way we talk about moving forward and working through immigration reform? We also then need to think about ways in which the failure to do this is, as we speak, separating families. For the first period for which we had a report, a six-month period from ICE, we got numbers that, in the neighborhood of 46,000 U.S. citizens, parents of U.S. citizens were deported from the United States. That's a big number, 46,000 families broken up over a six-month period. As we move forward, 46,000 families that are now facing significant challenges in terms of, losing a breadwinner and losing someone who is a point of care. We've got best estimate that I've seen 500,000 U.S. citizen children being raised in Mexico. Is that the way we want to raise our future generations of U.S. citizens and voters? Our policy choices here are fairly stark. And we're not saying, staple a visa onto a U.S. citizen child's birth certificate, but there is some middle ground to say, should we be finding a way to raise U.S. citizen children in the U.S.? Should we be finding a way to enable parents to have the status and stability in a home to be able to work with their children and support them and help, bring them to a positive childhood as they go forward and thrive. Immigration reform, I'm never particularly optimistic about. As Doris pointed out earlier, we often get strange bedfellows in immigration reform. And one of the places that's not so strange, but I think is not tapped for us, is thinking about all the family advocates and all the people who work in the settings that you work with to be able to point out, to be able to inform the debate with what's happening with separation of families, how that's impacting children, how that's impacting schools, how that's impacting education. That's a piece of the debate that comes into play and I think is missing, has been often missing in our reform as we look back and think about numbers and think about groups that we haven't really tapped all this, beautiful data that people talked about today and all these opportunities to say this is looking forward and this is how we're going to frame a debate that addresses some of these problems by figuring out how we're going to get not just kids status, not just our Dream Act kids, but how we're going to get family status, how we're going to work with kids who live in families, because that's where most kids live. Thank you.
So, okay, next is Hiro Yoshikawa from the Harvard Graduate School of Education, and he's going to take us into the policy realm and program from the legal framework that David has given us, and he's going to be doing PowerPoint.
First of all, thank you to MPI and to the Foundation for Child Development for supporting this chance to kind of review what we currently know about parental unauthorized status and its effects on kids, as well as think through what the exactly, I think, as David said, to consider current policy and programs that are related or may affect parental unauthorized status and associated experiences from the standpoint of children's development. And I'd like to acknowledge my co-author, Zhenya, wave your hand, Zhenya, who is a doctoral student at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. So you've heard this before. Of the 11 million unauthorized immigrants in the U.S., many are parents, with over 5 million children who have at least one unauthorized parent, and roughly 4 in 5 or over 4 million of those being U.S. citizens. So we can ask a basic developmental question of how those children fare compared to a reasonable comparison group, which might be low-income kids of low-income immigrant parents with other statuses. And then think about what are the implications when considering policy options from the standpoint of children's development. So I'm going to take you through those two questions in that order. The effects of parental unauthorized status on children and youth, this is a literature that is possible to summarize on one slide. We have very, very few studies that get to this question, but overall the message is that this is certainly not a protective factor in the lives of children, that in comparison, again, primarily to other low-income kids of other low-income immigrant parents with either legal permanent resident status or citizen status, there is evidence of some risk to kids, now stretching across early childhood into early adulthood, with one study finding evidence based on a proxy for unauthorized status of lower early cognitive skills. Two studies in middle childhood showing associations with lower levels of parent-perceived children's developmental status, one by Kalina Brabeck using a proxy of legal vulnerability for unauthorized status, and Alex Ortega actually using a measure of unauthorized status itself. In adolescents, out of Krista Pereira's North Carolina sample of Latino immigrants in a new gateway state, evidence of higher anxiety and depressive symptoms for adolescents with at least one unauthorized parent. And a recent study by Mark Leach, Jennifer Van Hook, who we heard from earlier, Frank Bean and colleagues, from a large data set in California, showing that by young adulthood, this is a sample of 5,000 all Mexican origin young adults, with data on both own and mom's and dad's unauthorized status, that by young adulthood, those growing up with an unauthorized mother, relative to an authorized mother, had completed between 1.25 to 1.50 fewer years of schooling, and that depended on the method for controlling for observable demographic characteristics that we know are correlated with unauthorized status. So all the traditional indicators of socioeconomic status, but particularly parental education, is correlated with unauthorized status. Then in the area of the single most dramatic family event, let's say, that that unauthorized status represents a risk for, and that is removal. And whether we think about the proceedings that may lead to removal or removal itself, the proceedings effects on child behavior, school attendance, and mental health are all in the negative direction. This is a study that Randy Capps and A.J. Chaudhry and colleagues did at the Urban Institute, a report called Facing Our Future, both in the immediate aftermath and then in a few months to a year later. So this is really literally all we currently know about the effects of parent unauthorized status on children and youth. If you do know of any other studies, please tell me, because I think particularly at this point in time, it's important that we know we have the best evidence in hand. So why is it? Why is it that above and beyond parental education, lower parental education levels, above and beyond perhaps language differences, above and beyond all of these correlates of poverty, that unauthorized status might matter? So in the Facing Our Future study, removal proceedings carried with them some very dramatic mechanisms, most clearly the income loss of losing often an earner in the household. But the psychological, mental health effects of parent-child separation, in some cases what we might call the post-traumatic effects of if the child witnessed the actual arrest and the parent being taken away, certainly mental health issues, isolation in the household in the immediate aftermath of the proceedings, and I refer you to the report for the full range of other family mechanisms. We have data that these families do have lower access to means-tested programs for U.S. citizen children. In other words, the mixed status matters. With the child being eligible for the full range of means-tested programs that provide benefits to citizen children, and the parent ineligible for services provided otherwise to low-income parents in public programs. And that includes factors that are relevant to children, like child care subsidies, housing subsidies, health care, as we heard, and what some folks, what perhaps isn't mentioned quite as often, is access to job training and human capital development programs, whether they're GED programs or federally funded workforce development, WIA dollars. There is evidence that unauthorized status, relative again to authorized status, if we look at low-wage workers, this is work by Annette Bernhard, Nick Theodore, and colleagues, that those are associated with substantially worse poor work conditions and economic hardship. And in our study in New York, we found evidence that between the ages 0 and 3 for children, unauthorized parents had rates of wages below the legal minimum wage in New York City, between 30 and 40% of them, depending on the wave of follow-up. In other words, depending on how old the child was and depending on whether it was the mother or father, with higher rates of wages below the minimum for the mothers than the fathers. There's some evidence that hardship and parent psychological distress might transmit some of the associations of unauthorized status with lower child cognitive skills in early childhood. And Roberto Gonzalez has done some of the best work about the developmental trajectory and the transition to awareness of one's own unauthorized status, typically in middle childhood or later in adolescence. And he calls this learning to be illegal, in other words, recognizing the barriers to one's educational and ultimately economic progress. As one realizes, and he shows a diversity of ways in which youth learn about their own unauthorized status, with blocked education and employment being clearly the most dramatic realizations that can really lower your own expectations, if not aspirations, for your own education. So in the paper, I also take a stab at what we currently know, and again, these are more hints, I would imagine, from these studies than very solid evidence, but are there exacerbating versus mitigating larger contexts? So certainly one that is policy-driven is the chronicity of unauthorized status across the family and developmental lifespan. The current wave, a large a chunk of the current wave of unauthorized parents really came in the large waves of migration starting in the early 1990s from Latin America, but also Asia and other parts of the world. And so they were coming at a time when paths to citizenship became increasingly restricted, so really since the 1990s. And so this is a status that these adults who came, and then as they made the transition to parent status, have retained that status now, some of them for decades. And so we can think about what that means in terms of a family lifespan and the length of exposure of a child to a parent's unauthorized status. And in part because of the recent history of immigration policy towards unauthorized immigrants in the U.S., this has had a kind of chronicity, which the earlier you came, the longer you've been exposed to. On the Great Recession, there is actually, we don't have a lot of great evidence as of yet, and it's not all clearly in one direction that the Great Recession necessarily exacerbated the experiences of or the ways that unauthorized status actually affects child development. Certainly some families returned, some parents returned to their home countries, and possibly with some parent-child separation accompanying that experience. There are certainly increased economic hardship and unemployment among many sectors, including Latino immigrant workers, but we don't have great data separating out the unauthorized from other low-wage workers, for example, among Latino immigrants in employment for Latino immigrants. Some work by Joanna Drebbe. Is Joanna here? I don't think I saw her. She's actually a young scholar looking at the experiences of unauthorized parents and their young children in two different settings. One that is fairly rich in social services and social capital, and one that is poorer, relatively speaking, in two different states, New Jersey and Ohio. And there it appears that that context really makes a difference, as we know it does from the larger immigration literature. The access to social capital, the kinds of information coming in, for example, about enrollment of children in programs that might help them, like preschool programs, these kinds of things are affected by social network density, closure, and the quality of information coming in. And in our study in New York, I found that it looked like the concentration of unauthorized in your network also made a difference. And as an unauthorized parent, if those adults in your network or at home were also unauthorized, that meant that there was simply less information coming in about supports for children's development. So in the paper, I go through a couple different categories of policies as far as their implications for children. And the first set is really policies that are directly potentially modifying unauthorized status. And of course, the pathway to citizenship, which is kind of the central feature of comprehensive approaches to immigration reform, would provide the most fundamental approach to reducing this risk factor in the lives of these millions of U.S. children. The Deferred Action Regulation and the DREAM Act both focus, as you know, on young, for in the case of deferred action, younger than 31, in the case of the last version of the DREAM Act that was proposed, under age 35. So relatively young, relatively college-ready, participating in educational activities or with a history of recent participation. This, from the perspective of the current community-based organizations, for example, that are facilitating deferred action applications, what they have told me is that the proportion, they recognize that there's a substantial proportion of this population that are parents. And yet they see relatively few parents coming in with applications. And this may be both because the ones who are least college ready and the ones who are not participating in educational activities would need to actually enroll in some programs, and precisely the barriers that keep them from enrolling in these programs, like GED programs, require a whole set of interventions before the application can happen to deferred action. So that's thanks to some colleagues at the New York Immigration Coalition, the Yale Immigration Law Clinic, for providing some of that information. But we don't have really the data yet in terms of the numbers, separating out the number of parents who are among the applicants to deferred action, let alone then what is their, you know, what's the ultimate decision. Temporary worker programs. We have no evidence from the history. We have a long history in the United States of temporary worker programs, and some that are being or about to be implemented in some states like Utah. Things like the Bracero program in the mid-20th century. We, of course, have no data on how children fared as a result of those programs. But from the the most relevant evidence, I think, concerns parents' reluctance to enroll their children in particular programs, which it turns out that legal permanent residents had a set of concerns about the potential ways that enrolling children in programs or receiving certain benefits might affect their chances for citizenship. And we can think about temporary worker programs as potentially occurring in a whole variety of different ways. But one example by which it might affect children or matter for children is if a temporary worker program does not actually provide a Social Security number access, it would actually exclude receipt of the Earned Income Tax Credit, which is the nation's most largest anti-poverty program. A program that has benefits for children's school achievement, shown in a national study by Dahl and Lochner. Workplace conditions, which we know are substantially worse for the unauthorized. There is a policy choice between advancing employer verification at the national level, which is one of the top things, I think, on the agenda, which, if it happened alone, would have, I think, different implications potentially for children than if it occurred in the context of more comprehensive approach to worker legalization. And there's actually an excellent report from MPI about the fact that an employer verification system, simply strengthening that without worker legalization, might actually drive another chunk of employers unauthorized immigrants further into a hidden underground economy, with some employers not participating, meaning some employees still being subject to the kinds of conditions and in some cases exploitation that unauthorized workers experience. Reducing the key risks of wage violations and wage stagnation, which research shows are detrimental to kids' academic as well as behavioral development, requires thinking about workplace inspections and programs that would strengthen those inspections. A strategy that could be enhanced within the context of worker legalization and employer verification as an approach to registering, for example, beginning to register the unauthorized. But thinking about any of these in isolation, I think, has somewhat different implications for kids. In terms of enforcement directed policies, their prosecutorial discretion is a regulation, a memo that was released by the Obama administration. In terms of during removal proceedings, how much are certain factors taken into account to make the decision about removal? And should, for example, as Obama said repeatedly during the last administration, should we really focus on those who've committed the more serious offenses? And then on the positive side, take into account immigrants who have strong family and community ties. So despite the release of that memo, there is evidence that there has not been a lot of consideration of those family and community ties with, as David said, over 46,000 parents of U.S. citizen children removed between January and June of 2011. Another way that the Department of Homeland Security and Immigration and Customs Enforcement has moved forward is reducing unnecessary detainment and associated parent-child separation, and this literally happened just around Christmas. One of the fun things about writing this report is every time I looked at the newspaper, there was something else to include because there have been new regulations. There have been some changes, actually, in that 3- and 10-year policy of for folks waiting before they come back from their country of origin. For example, that was another change just in the past few weeks. A policy area that we talked about this morning that is extremely important for this population is providing universal access to early education. And among the 40 or so state public pre-K programs, for example, that are currently being implemented across the United States, only 8 of them are providing non-means-tested pre-kindergarten. It happens to be that two of those contexts are places where the research has shown very strong and positive impacts on children's school readiness skills, and one is the Tulsa program that Deborah was involved in the evaluation of, and one is a program in the Boston Public Schools that Christina Weiland and I recently completed an evaluation of. Interestingly, in the Boston program, the effects on children's language and math skills were positive across the board, whether they were more middle-class families or lower-income families, but the effects were simply stronger in their positive effect size for the lower-income families. This is a policy where we the reluctance to enroll the citizen child, which is often due to providing proof of employment and earnings. This is the big block, for example, for some unauthorized parents to access child care subsidies for their child. And despite the fact that Head Start and Early Head Start have don't have such onerous requirements, they do have a means test, which universal pre-K programs would not. And so that is one reason why I think universal pre-kindergarten programs are a policy to think about in terms of children's school readiness. And just a historical note, the original vision for Head Start, the federal Head Start program, was one that was much more mixed income than what was eventually implemented. Turning to community-based organizations and what difference they can make, I think Rob started to talk about some of this from our Urban Institute study, where the three states were Texas, Massachusetts, and North Carolina. Some of the most responsive organizations were ones that were looking at the paperwork issue and realizing that if a parent comes in and they perhaps don't realize that the paperwork demands are different if they are only enrolling their citizen child versus enrolling themselves in a particular program, that perhaps the parents could be informed of this early, in literally in a meeting with a caseworker. And so that's an example of how community-based organizations were being responsive. Advocacy organizations suggested some of these changes, and some of the state agencies, like the Departments of Transitional Assistance or Medicaid, were responsive in changing some of their paperwork assessment practices. Another organizational practice, which in fact the New York Immigration Coalition was successful in conducting, was identification drives. So there are both policies that are municipal forms of identification. Here the barrier is the reluctance to get driver's licenses as kind of the principal form of photo identification in the U.S. And for example, in New York City, it had been the case that you could not pick up your child at school without a driver's license. And so after pushing for a change, the city agreed to allow foreign passports as well as consular identification to serve that purpose. And so the New York Immigration Coalition conducted, in collaboration with the Mexican consulate drives in high concentration immigrant neighborhoods, with tens of thousands of parents actually getting that form of identification through those drives. Another is the possibility of CBO workers providing, being an in-between, a third party, in terms of being able to facilitate earnings verification for access to, again, to means-tested benefits for children. Then I think Rob mentioned this, but we found some examples in our states of particularly close communication, even monthly meetings, for example, between advocacy organizations and the state departments of Medicaid or transitional assistance, SNAP, foods, and WIC. And that kind of close communication, I think, gets at some of the issues we were talking about earlier in terms of the specificity of particular immigrant flows in a city, for example, and the variation in the family needs, the cultural factors that might drive enrollment, specific fears of enrollment, for example, and immigrant serving organizations and advocacy organizations can play a major role. So in closing, and I would really love to hear everyone's thoughts on the specific piecemeal policies that Doris mentioned and how each of them might be considered from the standpoint of children's development. So this paper is an attempt to do that. And not surprisingly, I do think there are benefits of comprehensive immigration reform rather than piecemeal reform for children. Certainly the full pathway to citizenship, the role of, for example, Social Security and number in accessing the EITC, this idea of not a piecemeal can partly mean only affecting a portion of the population. And if we think of the DREAM Act, for example, it's limited in its ability simply to address the entire population of parents, unauthorized parents in the U.S. Thinking about employment policies in just within that realm in a more comprehensive versus more piecemeal way, with employer verification only being a piecemeal approach and one that kind of pairs with that workplace inspections or worker legalization processes as being more comprehensive, with, I believe, greater benefits is what the literature would suggest for the more comprehensive approach. And the variety of ways that in implementation, reducing the barriers to enrolling citizen children and the supports that aid their development should be taken into account. For example, if there is a temporary worker program, it is likely that these kinds of reluctance or fears to enroll children might continue. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you very, very much. That was a great survey and a great synthesis into the program and policy realm. We are going to move up to the front now, and with that, Kelly is going to make some comments from the standpoint of experience in the Department of Homeland Security. Kelly may be known to some of you because although she has been in various aspects of immigration in the government for many, many years, and we know each other through a number of associations over that time. She's throughout all of that in the General Counsel's office, at the State Department, now at the Department of Homeland Security, really been interested in children and children's issues, and has been a real fighter where children's issues are concerned, unaccompanied minors, other things in the way they've come up. So I'm delighted to have you meet her and her meet you, and she has an opportunity now to comment on these papers as well as share anything else that you might like to share about the state of play on children's issues in DHS. So come on up, and then Kelly, you have the podium.
Good afternoon, everyone. Usually when I come to MPI, I basically know everyone in the audience, so it's exciting to see some new faces, and I'm very glad to be here with you this afternoon. I'm going to try to react to the papers and then also give some information about some of the work that we're doing in the United States government. And I think first maybe I would start off by telling you that I've been working in these on these issues really for the past 20 years, and I've seen a change within the government on how we address these issues. And we have tried, I think, with some success, but certainly we are not perfect, and we're far from perfect, to look at children's issues from a more child-centered perspective. And I think when I started in government, I thought, oh, if you're a lawyer and you have a human rights background, you know, this is the perfect answer. I think now, on these issues, I wish we had more people with masters of social work that are in the discussion. So to that end, we do have an interagency working group comprised of Department of Homeland Security, Department of State, Health and Human Services, and Department of Justice. And any experts who'd like to become a part of that can feel free to contact me. Our next meeting will be on January 23rd, and we're going to be talking about a best interest determination, even with respect to some decisions the U.S. government makes on children's issues. So there's so many different things I could start off with, but just to set the table on the issue of families and lawful immigration status, for those of you who aren't immigration experts, you should know that the United States is the most generous in terms of valuing or placing a weight on families for immigration. So for the United States, actually last year, 65% of people who who became lawful permanent residents, it was based on a family relationship. It was a much smaller number for our labor-based. And when you compare that to, for example, Australia, 32% were family-based, and in Canada it was 19.5%. So our system does value family reunification and does create avenues for it in a way that no other country in the world does. Now, obviously, we have a large population of people here who are do not have immigration status, and clearly they are, as was pointed out, both people with both parents here, one parent here, one parent who's lawful, one parent who's not lawful. And it is true that we have separated families by removing some parents to third countries, which has created, obviously, a significant problem for that family and has made their situation difficult both emotionally and financially for their whole. So that is definitely true. It is also true that the Obama administration, following along with what Doris did when she was the head of the Immigration Naturalization Service, has really tried to prioritize removals. And the number one group of people that are prioritized for removal are persons who pose danger to the public safety through either national security or criminal grounds. And so I suspect, I don't have the figure, but a large number of the people who were removed with U.S. citizen family members do have a criminal background. So that, I think, is important to note, wasn't a decision that was taken lightly. In terms of a very important initiative that's already been alluded to, I can give you some sense of the deferred action for childhood arrivals. On the day it was announced, I was at Fairfield University speaking at this Humanitarian Action Network, and five of the students from around the country were there, and I was able to tell them firsthand that they'd be able to apply for it. And the measure of relief on their face and excitement was really a great day for them and for me to get to see that. We have had over 350,000 applications to date. We've already been able to grant over 100,000 young adults and adolescents DACA. So they will be able to work with they'll have an EAD and be able to really, I think, in some way feel more comfortable for the next 2 years. Obviously, that is not the end of their situation, and comprehensive immigration reform, which the president has said is something that he places a great value on, would obviously be a much better situation for those children and young adults to find themselves in. And it would be interesting to look at the data of parent versus non-parent in that population. I hadn't focused on it, and it is an interesting thought. From my perspective, what will be very interesting and has not been done enough of, and since you all have this background, I invite you to engage in research in this matter. I would like more study of children, children's outcomes of asylees, refugees, and trafficking victims. So we know who they are. We have over 2 million refugees since the passage of the Refugee Act in the United States, and I'd like to see how quickly their educational successes marry up with natural-born U.S. citizens or even children of maybe immigrants here who have the different language skills. So it would be interesting to see that. That is something that there's also very little research on. I can tell you that firsthand because we've actually looked for that data. Another thing that may make you comfortable is that as we've been looking at our guidance for adjudication of children's claims, treatment of children, we have been working with academics on this, and for example, we are engaged in discussions to train our Border Patrol on child-friendly interview techniques. This may sound a little scary to you that they're interviewing children, but they are when they encounter them on the southwest border, and I witnessed the training, and it was excellent. We had a PhD who was talking about child responses and giving them a really clinical approach to why the child was what the child was experiencing and what the child may be predicted to do and how to make sure that one was aware of those situations, and we'd like to expand that. We've also been working with the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees and letting them do a pilot study of our treatment of children at the southwest border. We've been working with the International Committee of the Red Cross and getting them interested in this, and not just on children but also on the mentally ill. It's another very vulnerable population that Department of Homeland Security comes in contact with. So these are some of the initiatives that have been taking up a lot of our time. There's a Department of Homeland Security and Focus. There's a Department of Homeland Security intra-agency working group, which has CBP, ICE, and CIS. And, for example, we will be bringing all our field office child coordinators to Washington to talk to them about treatment of children. I would say for the children traveling alone or unaccompanied alien children, which is the term used under the Trafficking Victims Protection Act, we have seen a significant rise in the number of children coming. We anticipate this year 19,500 children will come to the United States without a parent or legal guardian. That's three times the number from 2 years ago. So we are looking at the causes of that. Obviously, we think that there are three. More studies being done on this, and Carnegie and other MacArthur and other foundations have been actually prioritizing some of the research on this. But it seems to us that since it's primarily three countries which track the adult arrivals, it's El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala. Interestingly, not Nicaragua. It is extreme poverty, family relationships, trying to reunify with a family member, and fear of gang violence. So these are the push and pull factors for children that are coming to the United States now. So we have in place a whole series of protections for those children, but it's a constant need for us to adjust that, and we are looking at ways to make that process, that window of period of time where the child is with the U.S. government, either with Department of Homeland Security or Health and Human Services, as child-friendly and as beneficial to them as possible. We've also been working with the First Ladies of those countries and Central America and Mexico to try and figure out if there's things we can do to address and deter the children from taking to the United States. I will say, and I don't have data on this, but there is some disturbing anecdotal evidence that there's more violence against children now than there was 5 or 10 years ago. And my personal view on that is that it has to do with the length of time it takes for the child to get here. So in earlier days, one could get here quicker. And so ironically, the safe houses are probably less safe now than they have been historically. It's a terrible situation, and I think real study of the violence against children and women and men, actually, on the trip north is something that deserves more thought and knowledge and attention, and obviously prevention and prosecution as well. I will say, and I know some of it's already been covered, but ICE has made tremendous steps to try and address some of the issues involved with family relationships. Some of you may have heard of the case of Felipe Montes, which made the news. It was a very sympathetic case where, in my view, he was not a priority for removal. He was removed before the series of interventions that John Morton did as the head of ICE were put fully into place. So there's a series of civil enforcement memos about the priorities. And in this case, he had several traffic violations. He was removed to Mexico. His U.S. citizen wife, this is all public information you can read about on the Internet, his wife suffered from mental illness, and their three children were removed from the house. The children were separated. One child was placed with one family and the older two children with another. And he was trying to assert his parental rights from Mexico, which was quite different in a North Carolina state court. So to their credit, ICE, my colleagues, paroled him back in, and he's able to assert his parental rights. This is becoming an issue with the consulates, so we've been asking the consulates proactively if they could identify a circumstance, any case in which somebody is at risk of having their parental rights terminated because of an immigration enforcement action, and we would work with them to intervene so that that situation does not happen. Unfortunately, I'm aware of one case where we weren't notified that occurred in the Midwest, and we're still trying to figure out if there's a way to intervene now in that case where it was a Guatemalan woman who had her parental rights limited because of her immigration status, and that's certainly a very troubling trend and something that we do not feel comfortable with, and we're willing to work on as well. To comment on some of David's comments as well related to some of the points he made, obviously the hardship to a U.S. citizen child is a gap in the current law, and the changes to cancellation really quite significantly impaired some genuine families from being able to get that benefit, and that's absolutely true. We do think, though, that we are trying to perhaps that one of the ways that can be addressed is through CIR and through what we do in the future on that. And I think that area, as well as what we've done administratively on the 3 and 10 year bar, is an important area of focus. I think it's really a shame that 245I was expired, because that actually kept families in many ways together in a situation that I don't think that there's a desire to have 245I revived, which in my view would be a good thing. So I'm not going to rattle off the ICE initiatives. They are on their website, but they are important to know as it's changed the way ICE has prioritized its work. And again, I would just like to close by inviting you, if you're interested, to join us in our work on unaccompanied minors. You'd be very welcome to join us as experts in this discussion. And if you have a particular case related to it, obviously, I want to say don't call me, but you may call me. I feel like I'm the person with my name on the wall. The way to work on a case where you think prosecutorial discretion or other factors has not been properly evaluated or advanced is to talk to the person locally, subsidiarity, If you can't get a result there, we have ombudsmans in CIS. We have an advisor, Andrew Strait, at ICE, and we have others that can take it on. And again, if it's a pattern or practice or even an individual case that you think merits some special second look, my name is well known to others, and you're invited to call me about that particular case. So I want to thank you very much for allowing me to speak to you, and I'm glad to answer any questions.
Okay, well, always appreciate hearing you, Kelly, and I'm all particularly pleased today at the specificity that bespeaks really working on the issues in constructive ways. So thank all of you, and we're coming to the end of a day full of rich information exchange. I don't know how much energy you all have left, but maybe have enough to raise hands for questions. We have a few minutes for questions, and just wait for the microphone to get to you.
Hi, thank you very much for this panel. My name is Jennifer Keyes Adair. I'm at UT Austin. And my question is about when federal and state policies kind of hit heads in immigration, and we know obviously that that happens a lot, but I'm wondering about the institution of school being caught up in that. There's raids, and kids have to stay at school, and the teachers protect them, and kind of watching out for those in terms of those emotional health issues and things like that. So I'm wondering, kind of with the comment, if you see that getting worse, where schools are somehow participatory, there's lots of threats that schools need to turn families in if they find out children are undocumented, things like that that happen in, at the state level when federal and state things collide.
I'll just say, you know, it's a battleground, and I think it's an important place to toe the line and really push our institutions, our state institutions, to question their role in enforcing federal immigration law. You know, I think one of the things we've done through secure communities and other things over time is you know, deputize a lot of people to be involved in immigration law and in the law enforcement realm, and I think it's really dangerous if we start, you know, letting that filter through to schools and letting that filter through to people who feel unsafe to go to family court because they might be picked up, or if they're coming out of juvenile proceedings, or if they're coming out of divorce proceedings. And I think, you know, there's a really appropriate role for ICE in terms of enforcing immigration law and knowing where to go. But, you know, they do have policies in place to say that there are vulnerable sites and schools are among them where they shouldn't be doing enforcement. And you know, we had an incident in Detroit similarly, you know, a couple within the last year. And so I think, you know, it's always important for the communities to keep pressure on ICE to sort of respect that and understand those limits. But we do need to keep those separate because, you know, we have this contradiction going on where we have, you know, people who are without status, but they otherwise have rights to be educated and to participate in society. And this is where they reside and this is their home. So, you know, it's a hard thing, and I know, you know, probably I the message from the top is always strong and good, I think, and you know it trickles down to what happens at a particular incident in a particular environment usually.
Yeah. I would add too that you know, David just referred to that October 24th guidance, but also we had to ask the schools for help with DACA, so this was. In order to show that they were here, we actually had to affirmatively ask the schools to be one of the groups that gave information that helped them establish eligibility. So we worked very closely with the Department of Education on this, talked to them about the circumstance, and, you know, in different parts of the country, there's different reactions to this. So it was an educational opportunity for me to realize how difficult some of the Education Department decisions are made. But it was very... I think generally we got great cooperation on this, and it was a very important situation. It's not just schools, too, that are considered sensitive locations. It's funerals, churches, hospitals, marches. And so that guidance is out there, and it's supposed to be adhered to. It's important to give that space, persons in that situation, comfort to be able to attend.
If I could just say one other thing that's interesting with... When we're talking about state policies and wrapping up against our federal immigration policies, it's one of the reasons we really want to push for a pathway to firm lawful immigration status, ultimately citizenship, where you don't leave questions open for interpretation state by state as to what about these semi-legal statuses. North Carolina today said you have to issue driver's licenses to people who get DACA. That's a great victory. Other states have come out the other way. But the fact that we're having that debate and having those questions is because we're stuck in this situation where, because we haven't legislated and found a pathway that really gets us to a permanent answer, the administration has stepped in and had to do something that gets us part of the way there but doesn't get us all the way there. And then it leaves us with just more to fight over.
Yeah, I mean, that is the core point. Yes.
Thank you. Yes, thank you for your presentations. They've been very informative, and I appreciate that. My name is Lista Rojas Flores, and I am at the Graduate School of Psychology at Fuller Seminary in California. We're talking about instances of support, like education, and now we have child welfare. And when we look at the impact of detention and deportation of parents of citizen children and the apparent increase rates of these citizen children in the foster care system, what kind of federal and state initiatives have been taking place to address that particular issue that is exacerbating the impact on kids that are citizens and are having their parents deported? We know that some kids, if the parents are picked up at home and there's no one to take care of them at that moment, they will be sent to a foster care agency. And we also know that because of the lack of communication between the detainee and the constant movement between detention centers, oftentimes these parents do lose their parental rights, and we have multiple issues that these kids are facing besides the separation. So I just wanted to know, what are some of the initiatives that you know are happening at the federal and state level regarding that particular issue?
Well, the detainer guidance, the recent detainer guidance, was that?
Well, I was going to say that there's both a toolkit on dependency, and then there's guidance on family court proceedings and permitting the person to intervene in the family court. So anytime somebody is detained in the United States for an immigration violation, we will make every effort to get them to be able to participate fully in any family court proceeding that is going on, and that's guidance out there to the field right now. On the larger question, though, about children being removed if there's a single parent, the guidance is generally that the arrest should not occur unless it's, you know, an extreme crime, that you would not remove a single parent from a situation where there are children in the house without a very good reason. And if that was done, it would be done with in coordination with the state to make sure that there was somebody to care for the children. But that would be a very unusual circumstance and should not, as a general matter, happen.
I think, you know, on the state level, it's a good news, bad news scenario. As issues of family separation and parental rights and with immigrant families get litigated up the chain, every case that gets litigated to a highest court in a state wins, saying, you know, immigration status does not determine parental rights, it doesn't weaken parental rights, it doesn't have anything to do with parental rights. But that's not what's happening in the trial courts in the first instance, right? So, you know, and not every case gets, you know, has resources to be appealed up. So on one hand, we're seeing good law develop, but we're also seeing bad practices develop on the ground. And part of that is that the family resources, the child welfare resources, don't know that ICE has a policy that they will get that parent there. They don't reach out and find that parent. They don't necessarily want to reach out and find that parent. And so proceedings go forward, and there's not communication, and there's not coordination. And so a real need for training exists at the state level to really put a focus there and to make sure that what federal resources are available are known and taken advantage of.
Yeah, and to that end, we've asked a number of times our colleagues at Health and Human Services to let us participate in their outreach with the states for just that reason, because there's a very uneven knowledge in the states about immigration, and so I think this would be a very good educational opportunity. We're also aware that there are some states that have taken children in who are unaccompanied children who are entitled to HHS benefits, and we would like them not to be with the state. And we're also aware of some states unilaterally returning children to a foreign country, which we're also opposed to, as they have rights under federal law, and they may have a family member here that the state is not aware of. So
that's a practice that we would like to see stop. So we would be very willing to work with the states on increasing their knowledge and their our interaction with them.
Okay, I think I saw another hand. I'm going to take one final question. Okay, up here, because we need to give you time to wrap up.
Hi, my name is Patricia Cianconi, and I'm from Prince George's County Public Schools here in Maryland. And I wanted to just find out a little bit about what is the specific that you said before, but you said associated separation. What is that specific guidance called? Is there a document that you said came out in December? I think.
Are you talking about the 3 and 10?
No. I want to know about that too. But that, I was talking, you said that recently, like when you, Mr. Yoshiko, when you were writing your paper, that new stuff came out about reducing.
Yeah.
Unnecessary detainment and associated parent-child separation.
Yeah, the reference to that is in the document, and then the 3 and 10 one, they're both within the past couple of months,
yeah,
and they're both referenced.
Yeah, we have three guidances on detention that that are on our website. One is March 2nd, one is June 17th, and one is October 24th. And those would really guide that issue. And so the age and capacity of a child is supposed to be a factor in looking at whether detention is appropriate for a parent.
Okay, we'll do this one last one. Saw you simultaneously, so pardon me.
Thank you to everyone, and thank you for MPI for organizing this important event. I wanted to highlight what Hebro had mentioned about the shortcomings of prosecutorial discretion, and I think a big part of that a lot of folks aren't aware of is that a lot of parents actually fall under mandatory detention, which actually ties the hands of ICE, and those can be folks who have committed certain crimes or have just reentered, and a lot of parents are actually coming back to reunify with their children who have remained in the U.S. And the recent numbers that came out of the Department of Homeland Security in December showed that actually 205,000 parents of U.S. citizens had been deported between July 1st of 2010 and September 30th of 2012. So even if we do succeed in passing immigration reform, we know that has a pathway to citizenship. We know that many of these parents are still not, some of these parents may not qualify for whatever reason for that legalization process. So we need protections in place for when enforcement happens, that we have protections in place for children who might be left behind. And so, Kelly, I know you mentioned some of the policies with regards to access to family court proceedings and those types of measures, but we're really concerned, too, with parents having access to a phone call to make child care arrangements. There was a law recently passed in California that ensures that parents have two phone calls for that purpose, and I'm just curious as to what the department's willingness to consider that would be.
Well, I can't speak for ICE today on whether two phone calls or five or one, but I do know we do have the guidelines governing detention and contact with the outside world, and while they've been slow in being renegotiated because of some union issues, that obviously we want kids to be able to be in communication with their parent and to be able to visit their parent. And that is supposed to be taken into account with the risk classification and including changes of venue so that we keep parents, if they have to be detained, as you point out, some do by law, that they're in the same geographic area as their kids. So it is in our interest and in the interest of the family to stay as close as they can together, and we would want to always try to work towards that end.
And California also just, together with the phone call law, also passed the Reuniting Immigrant Family Act, which provides some other protections and slows down some timelines to try and ensure that family court proceedings don't rush through while immigration matters are being sorted out. And that's an important law and a great model for other states to pick up.
Okay. I'm going to bring this to a close with the comment that if we ever needed any reminder in this day of how at the level of reality this actually, the complexity of all of this, and so many of these things could be worked out with effective legislation that is, encompassing and embracing, but as you point out, even legislation is not going to solve all these things. There's just a tremendous amount of intersections among all of these realms where communication and information and training and further research, you know, are needed. So with that, let me turn it over to my colleagues to try to sum this up and talk to you about where we're going to go with this. Thank you all.
For more information on the Migration Policy Institute's Young Children of Immigrants Conference, visit www.migrationpolicy.org/integration.